Welcome to the Danger Close podcast, presented by Six Hour.
I would fight back really, really quickly, learn that if there's two of them and you do that, well, they'll bring four guys in next time. So they used to have paraffin heaters. They would heat spoons up and then help you with your wounds and burn you on your on your cuts. My back teeth that were smashed up were pulled out by a guy who said he was a dentist. There's nothing you can do. There is nothing you can do. It's just trying to keep the integrity of your mind, really.
My guest today is Andy McNabb. Andy is a former British SAS soldier who led Bravo 20 during the first Gulf War. He was captured, tortured for 3 weeks before his eventual release. He wrote about that experience in a book called Bravo 20, which is one of, if not the best-selling memoirs of modern warfare ever written. He followed that up with Immediate Action and then Seven Troop, and is now the author of over 30 different books. He also helps out consulting in Hollywood to include the Michael Mann robbery heist film, Heat. Without further ado, Andy McNabb.
Conduct under capture module. You sit it's about a week, and everybody, a selection of people who've been held against their will, whether they're prisoners of war, political prisoners, kidnap victims, you know, for money, anybody who's been held, you know, journalists would come in who've been held, you know, where they've been reporting. And what they would talk about is their experiences. And you would, you know, then you'd have a Q&A afterwards. And the idea was that if you listen to all these different people's experiences, if there's something, just a sentence that helps you if you're caught, because obviously, you know, special forces, they're prone to capture troops, same as aircrew, you know, so they, if there's something, just one thing that's going to help you when you're captured, it's worth sitting there for a, you know, for a week listening to all these different people's experiences. And obviously for me during the Bravo 20 experience, it worked very well, indeed. French woman living in London when war broke out, and she was a dressmaker. SOE got hold of her and they said, right, you're going to go back to France, and basically we just want you to blow up stuff. And she's gone, yeah, okay. She's 19. Wow. So she gets her training. She parachutes. They jumped her into Holland, and the idea was then she was going to get moved back in France. And she started operating and was caught and had, it was something about 2 years of interrogation. She's, you know, she never broke out of her cover story, you know, constantly, you know, obviously denying what she was doing. And then eventually landed up in a concentration camp, and you know, and then was liberated. And the thing that kept her going was the fact that her family was still in France. So if she gave up her real identity, would her then family be rounded up as well? So and the amazing thing that she said, look, you can't do anything physically about what they want to do for you. Like you can't, there's not a thing you can do because they control you. So you just got to accept that and get on with keeping that sort of an integrity of her mind, of your mind. And that's all you can do. And that certainly sort of stuck with me from this woman who now was, you know, she was in her late 80s by then. You know, and this was from a, you know, by then, what, 20-year-old young French dressmaker. And then I heard exactly the same thing from an American Phantom pilot. He was a Navy pilot. You know, he had no hair, no teeth, you know, no muscle mass, but he was still alive, this guy. Literally, he'd flown 77 missions off of the aircraft carrier he was based on. Does 80 missions, and that's the end of his tour. 77th mission, he gets shot down. Spent 5 years in solitary confinement in Vietnam. Every major bone in his body had been broken. He had to self-heal. He had no muscle mass on his buttocks because it was just continuously sort of beaten out of him by a frayed bamboo. And he said exactly the same. He said, look, there's nothing I could do. He says, look, I was a Marine. I was, you know, when they first sort of, you know, started to sort of get hold of me and in effect beat me up, I would fight back and really, really quickly learn that if there's two of them and you do that, well, they'll bring four guys in next time. So just accept it. And this guy accepted what happened to him physically, just tried to minimize the damage, but he kept the integrity of his brain. And for him, his motivation was wanting to get back to see his child. And he built a house. Mentally, he built this house. And he had so much time, he redecorated it and he rewired it and he'd done all the, you know, and he said, I didn't have a clue about house building, but it didn't matter. I just, you know, done this process. His motivation was getting back to you know, to see his family. And it worked. You just accept it. It's, you know, within life, you know, everybody else is to blame. If something misfortune happens to you, there's the, you know, we live in a culture where somebody else is to blame, and it's, you know, it's not your fault and it's a system or an individual's fault. But the fact is, it doesn't change anything. If you're captured, you're in Baghdad, you're in an interrogation center. Well, you can blame whoever you want. Nothing's going to change that. So that's why, you know, I think that certainly the resistance to interrogation training was really, really helpful, because it just fought those two people. You just got to accept it and really just keep that integrity of the brain. When people are captured, there's still a job to do. You've got to retain that information to give, obviously, the headquarter element time to, you know, readjust. Say, well, you know, we haven't heard anything from Bravo 2-0. What does that mean? Well, the worst case scenario is everybody's captured and they're saying everything that they know. So how do we then minimize the risk to the other guys on the ground? So your job is to give that window of opportunity. And that really comes from, you know, the operational security at the beginning of any operation, where you're only told what you need to know. So if this situation does happen, even if you do blurt out everything you know, you can minimize it. So the headquarter element can look at it and go, this is what they know. Because as we plan and prepare, we go into isolation. So nobody knows what we're doing. We don't know what anybody else is doing. This is what they know. What can we change and adapt? So there's still a job to do, which is a big motivation. So we got split. So by the time I got to the border, I was on my own. I didn't have long until last light. And I thought, well, I can get out and then just get over the border. But I got a found. I still don't know how I was discovered, but there'd been trucks going over this culvert, you know, Iraqis going out looking and all that sort of stuff going on, looking for, which they assume were Israelis. Clearly, somebody had seen me somewhere, and they come in. They're firing all around the culvert, screaming and shouting. Jeez. And you know when lads get a bit excited? I'm not going to get out because it's just too much excitement and too many rounds going around. You know, you end up getting shot for excitement rather than anything else. So they wanted me out. I'm not getting out. They eventually dragged me out. We call it tactical questioning. Basically, just getting filled in.
Yeah.
So and I had some teeth knocked out. And
right outside the culvert.
Yeah. So there was lots of that. Literally, I thought I was going to be shot anyway. So taken in the vehicle, taken to a border town called Al Qaim, and there was a military base there.
Yep.
And that's where I met the guy who'd given up his own position to try and save this guy, Steve Lane, in the diesel shed. So then me and him got paraded through town, and the air war had started by then, so there was bombing every night now. So obviously everybody was taking their frustrations out on us, and we thought that we were going to get shot at the end of it.
Sure.
So we actually made it worse by retaliating. What we didn't realize, there was a reward that were given for down pilots and prisoners. Mm-hmm. And also, part of our escape kit, we always have gold with us.
We have 20 gold.
Yeah. They were straight after that. We get 20 gold sovereigns that we carry. We normally tape them up and put it inside the body on a thin belt. Mm-hmm. So it's like bribe money. So, you know, everybody knows the currency of gold. So obviously they had that as well. So everybody was very, very happy. Mm. We got there into the interrogation center and put into individual rooms, into these cells. And there was already somebody there. They were getting filled in, and it was clearly, a European voice. Mm-hmm. And it was another member of the patrol who'd been captured earlier on. And so it was three of us in the interrogation center. What they wanted to know was, well, for us to admit we were Israelis, to bring Israel in the war. And and looking back, it sort of made sense, you know, because we weren't dressed as regularly as like, you know, European Brit soldiers or whatever. We have a cover story. So we kick off with, first of all, the Geneva Convention, the big four, number, rank, name, date of birth, all that sort of stuff. And then you'd break into cover stories. And then the cover story was that we were medics from all different units, so you could talk in detail about your unit that you come from. You know, I'm a green jacket, I'm a medic. We were all brought together and we were going out to try and find down pilots, like a search and rescue teams.
Right.
And helicopter landed and took off and left us, and we're just trying to get home. Is it, you know, basically that. The downside really was the civilians, the secret police. Sort of conventions where, you know, the guards would come in and kick you about and punch you about, all that sort of stuff. But during the interrogations, you would go in, always handcuffed and blindfolded. And we were whipped, beaten with a like a metallic ball thing on a stick. My back teeth that were smashed up were pulled out by a guy who said he was a dentist and he practiced in London for 9 years. Mm. You know, again, because of this relationship we've had with them back in the war against Iran. So teeth pulled out. And so they used to have paraffin heaters. They would heat spoons up and then help you with your wounds and burn you on your on your cuts. And it was again that conduct under capture.
Yeah.
That's when I really was really thinking about, certainly the French woman and the Phantom pilot, Marine Corps Phantom pilot. There's nothing you can do. There is nothing you can do. It's just trying to keep the integrity of your mind, really. You know, this thing, you know, the Phantom pilot had 5 years of this. So I'm thinking, all right, I'm on week two or week three of this at the moment. You know what I mean? So, and that guy survived.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, well, okay, it's not good, but it's not as bad as what he had. And he survived. So that's, you know, let's take the lessons from that and learn it. So we were there about 3 weeks, around about 3 weeks. And again, every night getting taken hits in the compound. You know, the bombing was continuous.
And the whole time they keep asking you if you're Israeli. Is that
Israeli. It changed after about 2 weeks. I don't even know why I didn't think about it before. We're going, we're not, you know, we're search and rescue teams, we're this. Basically, I've got a foreskin. I said, look, I've got a foreskin. And they're going, what? Well, yeah, again, we obviously in Islam, there's circumcision. And so I'm going to try and explain it. I said, look, I'll show you. Take the handcuffs off and I'll show you. Which was difficult because it was like February now in Baghdad. It's pretty cold. So I'm like pulling it out. And the guys in this just started laughing and shoved a date in my mouth. I thought, right, well, that was good. Then they said, right, well, what are you doing here? We just kept with the cover story. We then were moved to, we didn't know it at the time, to a prison, Abu Ghraib. That's when we start to meet a lot of pilots, shot down pilots that were being brought in. There was no interrogations there, no proper interrogations. But again, it's, you know, they're taking hits in a compound, they're taking casualties. So it was everything from guards coming in, you know, with sticks and batons, that sort of stuff.
Right.
There was another guy who wanted to hear me sing songs from Queen, you know, because he was a Queen fan, you know.
Wow.
And then at one side, I had to eat my own feces for a joke. But by the, everybody by then, we all got hepatitis anyway while we were there. But, you know, clearly that didn't help because it was a joke. And it was going back to that thing, you know, what the French woman and the Phantom pilot said. She's got no control, you know. So do you not do it and then get another beating, or do you just do it, you know, and get on with it and do it? So I decided to get on with it. One of the big problems was the taking hits in a compound from the bombing every night. Every night, just literally, you could, you know, you knew it was going to happen within, literally as soon as it was last light, it would happen.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, it happened during daylight. Well, we thought it was bombing, but what it was fast jets going over Baghdad because the war had happened, and they were going supersonic, and they were sonic booms.
Wow.
Over the city. And what they were trying to tell people was down below prisoners that it was over, the war was over. It got involved in the conduct under capture, both here and the United States, the FBI enrichment program, and for maybe about 9-10 years, part of the free services, the Army, Navy, and the Air Force, part of their training is they got to listen to me waffle on for about like 2 hours on a DVD talking about conduct under capture and, yeah, you know, the lessons learned and what works and what doesn't work, and trying to explain it. Basically, you know, I was just saying about exactly what the SOE woman and the Phantom pilot were saying.
Yeah.
Because they're absolutely right. You've got no control. Just accept that and just keep trying to keep some integrity of your mind.
Bravo 2-0 made such an impact on an entire generation of those who go stand up to defend their countries. But there's this one, I've never forgotten the last line, which is absolutely brilliant. And I just want to read that because from first read to today, it's never left me. And you write, this is the very end in the epilogue. And you say, "And as for the people who interrogated me, if I met any of them in the street tomorrow and thought I could get away with it, I'd slot them."
Yeah.
Awesome. That's the best line to a novel.
It's true.
It's not a novel. I mean, this is, nonfiction, of course. Yeah. So the best ending line ever, in my humble opinion.
Thank you for that.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's totally brilliant. So, and I love it. And it resonated with me because I know it's true.